You're listening to a special bonus episode of Muscle Minds.
Hey guys, this is John Meadows.
And this is Scott Stevenson.
I invite everybody to come out to our seminar, Bodybuilding Fact and Fiction.
Thursday, March 1st at the Doubletree Suites in downtown Columbus. Just before the Arnold Classic festivities, come on in and meet John Meadows, IFBB Pro, the Mountain Dog himself, and Dr. Scott Stevenson. Stay all day from 9 a.m. to noon, then after lunch, 1 o'clock till 4. Starting out with an a.m. pancake breakfast, then all day lectures. Q&A as time permits, plus best bar ever and pre-workout from Granite Supplement Speed Force to get you on your way to the gym. For more information, go to drscottstevenson.com. That's drscottstevenson.com. And hope to see you guys there.
Advices Radio Network.
The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for entertainment and educational purposes only.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster.
Welcome to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson, Jordan Peters, and Scott McNally, part of the Advices Radio Network, a new voice in bodybuilding podcasting. Welcome back to Muscle Minds, part of the Advices Radio Network. I'm Scott McNally, and with me, as always, is Dr. Scott Stevenson. This is a special episode. Scott, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm excited. This is we got the man on today. This is going to be a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a special guest today. This is a man who likes pancakes maybe almost as much as I do. This is the original Grainster, the Mountain Dog himself, IFBB Pro John Meadows. John, thanks for being with us, man.
Oh, my pleasure. Happy to be here.
So, pancakes. I think that's where we have to start here. You got to tell me, man, what's your favorite pancake?
Oh, man. See, I just, there's a breakfast place here. It's called First Watch. I don't know if they have them where you're at. But I I was in Australia and I missed out for a week. So I just got back into town. I went back to First Watch this morning. They're like, man, where you been? I said, well, Australia, actually. And so today I actually got blueberry pancakes. But if I had to put, if I had to do my favorite, I'm going to have to say red velvet if they're done right. Sometimes they're a little too sweet, but if they're done right, oh man, they can add 5 to 10 years to your lifespan.
Then I'm on the right track. Those happen to be my favorite pancakes awesome. Too.
Antioxidant, AMPK, kinase activating pancakes.
Red velvet. All of it, man. All of that.
Nice. So where do you fit pancakes into your diet? It sounds like you're eating these in the morning. Is there any bodybuilding benefit to this, or is this just your choice because you like to eat them?
Well, I call them stress relievers. They make me happy, and I just generally have them in the morning. I don't usually have them too much, unless like I think when Scott was here the last time, I'm pretty sure we went to IHOP.
Oh, yeah.
So generally I just like them in the morning, man. It's funny, like everybody thinks like if you have anything funny, you're going to die. But I'll have to show you my latest round of blood work. I'm actually going to get it done tomorrow. I was looking through my blood work today and I haven't gotten it done in a while. So I went to, directlabs.com, and I did that 10 most important thing, which is usually what I get. So I bought that today, and I'm actually going to the Quest Lab tomorrow morning, and hopefully I'll be able to report back to you that the pancakes have lowered everything that needs to be lowered and increased everything that needs to be increased.
Scott,
case study, Serrano, Meadows et al. influence of pancake diet on blood parameters in a bodybuilder.
That's right.
I like it.
That's right.
I have two questions here. First is, Scott, where do you stand on pancakes? And then second is, how often do both of you guys get your lab work done?
Well, I have to defer to John. He's the real pancakeologist. I'm more of a sorbetologist. I guess you might say, an sociologist. But pancakes are, I mean, they're up there. I always love pancakes. I think I was born with the pancake gene too, and maybe it's, you know, there's some interference from the sorbet gene that sort of reduces my pancake intake. But I can't imagine. I mean, how bad would a day be if you wake up and have pancakes, and then go have sushi for lunch, and then some sorbet at night? I mean, that's good with me. But if we were to go into my kitchen with a camera, I think I have the old good old Krusty's.
Oh, those
brand.
Are good.
Yeah, those are just like the generic, like, you know, super high glycemic index. I've got some buckwheat pancake mix, a couple kinds of high protein pancake mix, several flavors. I probably have 10 or 12 packages of pancake and protein pancake mixes in my kitchen. So that tells you kind of how I think about pancakes.
Yeah, that says a lot.
When I was training out on the east side of Columbus back in the 90s, we used to go to a place that had buckwheat pancakes, and the guy who took me there always told me, like, man, if you really want to gain weight, you got to get these corn cakes. They're a lot heavier. And they are, man, like the ones that Scott are talking about. Like, if you eat one of those, it feels like you've had three of the regular ones. They're very heavy. They're very highly recommended to people who need to gain a few pounds.
Yeah. Buckwheat's actually a grass, and I think it's a complete protein. It's gluten free.
Really,
it's pretty good stuff. Yeah, it's low glycemic index too. But yeah, I like the taste. It tastes a little different than just like white flour. I think they're delicious. Yeah.
I love them. I love them too. Mary makes those for me every once in a while.
Mm.
Maybe I'll have to add those into my program then this off season.
Well, the interesting thing. So Scott just went through his three foods. So I just moved. Actually really close to Dr. Serrano, and there's a gym over here called Power Shack, and right across the street there is a sushi restaurant and there is a frozen yogurt place right beside it.
Nice.
And so many times that's what I do. I'll go to First Watch in the morning, I'll get my pancakes there, and then after I train I'll run across the street and I'll get my sushi and then I'll get frozen yogurt too. But Scott got me hooked on it's a black cherry sorbet. It's my favorite. And I remember I was so excited. I was competing in Missouri, I think it was, this year, Chad Nichols.
Yeah.
And I remember going to the restaurant there, or the grocery store. It was pretty close to the hotel. And I remember sending pictures to Scott of all the sorbet, going, look at all these I found. Because Scott got me kind of hooked on that stuff pre-contest. So I used that quite a bit this year.
I remember you mentioning that on the video where you were in Whole Foods and you guys were going through the store. How much sorbet were you eating? Because I thought you said it was like a canister a night for several nights.
A pint. Yeah, a pint every night. Yeah.
Okay. So that's a lot of carbs. So you needed that just to stay full?
Well, I mean, my metabolism was kind of up and down. And most of the time I would say my diet is pretty low in calories. And honestly, man, as hard as I train, I get close to show, I'm a little bit underfed, but you know, that's one of the reasons why I didn't do the 212 class this year, is because it's so hard to make that weight class. But I probably don't eat as much as you would think I would. So the carbs that Scott had me eat, actually, I think I really needed those carbs. I really do. It seems like a lot, but I remember I was eating them before I went to bed, and I remember I would wake up in the morning and just feel really, really good.
Nice.
So I don't know, man. You know, I get down 2,500 calories, and most people think that's a little crazy, but, you know, that's just one of the ways that I got pretty good condition. Just had to do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense to me. So, you know, you had mentioned your blood work. How often do you and Scott both get your blood work done?
Well, I used to do twice a year, and man, I've been traveling so much and I've been a little busy. I looked at my records today and I was a little disappointed. The last time I had it done was a little over a year ago. But I like to do it twice a year. So, you know, like I said, tomorrow I'm going to get it done. But I think it's interesting too, because I was donating a lot of blood, and that was kind of messing with some of the values too. And I actually haven't donated blood for probably a year. So I'll be interested in looking at, you know, the CBC panel to see if it looks a little wacky or if it's pretty normal.
Yeah. How about you, Scott? How often do you go in?
I try to go every year, and actually, I would have, I've been, you know, as we talked about before on the show, I've been kind of take care of my dog. So, I didn't get, actually, I was just looking on Direct Labs, which is where what I use to order the blood work. And I think I've got a pending requisition that I haven't even cashed in on. So nice. I think I started the process and then just like got distracted, or maybe, you know, sleep deprived, sleep deprivation, you know, screwed my memory up. But yeah, at least every year. And then if there's something that seems strange, you know, then check into that. You know, that's, I've done it a couple times a year, even three before, if I want to test something out, what have you, but at least every year.
Right, sure. Right on. So yeah. we started out here talking about pancakes, and I'm going to segue here, because one of the main reasons that we have John on today is to talk about the Columbus seminar that's going to be coming up before we know it. There's Scott tells me there's going to be pancakes at the seminar.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the plan.
So, and what's the name of this seminar? And let everybody know, first of all, when this is taking place. This is going to be in Columbus at the DoubleTree, and it's happening on Thursday before all the festivities. What's the name of it?
Bodybuilding Fact and Fiction.
Okay. And what are you guys going to be covering here besides pancakes?
Well, you know, we're going to cover a lot about training frequency, and we're also going to talk a lot about nutrition. But, you know, we're going to have some Q&A as well. That's where we're going to give you honest information, no matter what the question is. But, you know, I think Scott and I really enjoy talking about training frequency. When I travel and do these seminars, it's one of the things I really enjoy talking about. And then the nutrition part, I have some sections carved out on that to talk about specific pieces around insulin sensitivity and some other things. So we're going to cover quite a bit. It's a full day, and you know, so we're going to be cranking through a lot of info.
Interesting. And you guys are doing fact and fiction around PEDs specifically too, right? One of the talks.
Yeah, that and everything else, really. But I mean, that is there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of kind of hype and bad information around PEDs these days. And I think people get, you know, a lot of secondhand information that I think it's really puts people's health in jeopardy. And, you know, we all know that bodybuilding is very hard on you. We know that the PED part, it's not healthy, but there are ways to do this stuff where you're not, you know, putting yourself in harm's way, at least as bad as it can be. So, you know, we're going to talk about any questions that people have, but, you know, there's a lot of things we want to cover. We want to talk about insulin resistance, and specifically around growth hormone and how that can create problems. We're going to talk about really, really high levels of androgens and, you know, different problems that can cause. So, you know, we're going to cover quite a bit.
Interesting. And you also have, this is a sidebar, and I'll get back to this, but your website, you have a new section in the forums also related strictly to PEDs, correct?
Yeah. And this is not, I mean, I don't want to be a drug guru, right? Sure. That's never been what I'm after. There's plenty of those people around, but I think, again, just going back to what Scott and I are trying to cover at the seminar, there's a lot of bad information. So, you know, I figured the only way to counter that is to provide good information, right? So I'm going to have that section filled out here pretty soon. I just did, I just covered insulin use. I just put that video up maybe 2 weeks ago. I just did another video on metformin and actually brought in Dr. Serrano to talk about that as well. So, the goal is to provide good information. There are other sites out there that talk about PEDs, but I don't know, man. I just think it's getting so aggressive these days. It's just a little out of control.
So do you think, you know, I mean, I hear stories and I hear people who've said, you know, guys are using 5+ grams of gear at the upper level. Do you feel that for some people that's necessary? do you think that that's always going to be too much, even at that level?
I've never done that much myself.
Okay.
I don't know what's necessary for every single person out there. I don't know what's necessary, but I can give you some perspective on what works really well. You know, I've worked with a lot of IFBB pros, and the absolute biggest and largest guy I've worked with who's won pro shows, you know, he went up to a little over a gram, and that's the highest dose I've ever had anybody on. And I feel like that's a big dose, but he was a big guy. I mean, most of the guys that I've worked with are 700 megs, 800 megs of test, and 400 or 500 megs of some other items. But this 5 gram stuff, this is insanity, man. There's nothing magical in my mind that's going to happen between 4 or 5 grams. At least I don't think there is. Now, maybe if I tried that, maybe it would happen. Maybe I would have shot up another 5 or 10 pounds in muscle. But I see these guys going higher and higher in doses. And, you know, I got to believe there's a law of diminishing returns. I got to believe that a certain number, you're just going to have, you're just going to increase the risk of side effects. You know, when I went to, it's kind of funny. I went to Westside Barbell to train in the mid 90s. And those guys had a reputation like these are the aggressive guys with drugs. And so I got there and I'm like, you know, I went there to train because I really enjoyed powerlifting. And Mike Francois was going there at the same time. But I was kind of wondering, I'm like, so what is all this crazy gear these guys are doing? And you know what the guys were doing? And, you know, I can tell you what they had me do was 500 megs of test a week. And I remember thinking back then, man, that's a pretty good dose, like 500 megs. That's a lot. So every Saturday morning, man, I'd wake up and I'd take my 2.5 cc's of Cypionate. And I thought, man, I'm cranking. I'm going hard. You know? And then I get to the USA 1999 out in California. And this was probably the first time I had some really good conversations with guys about growth hormone. So I'm talking to these guys backstage, you know, and they're like, you know, I do 9 IUs. The other guy's like, well, I do 10. Another guy's like, well, I do 8. And I'm just like, oh, my God. Like, I had just done Humatrope for the first time in my life, and it was 2 IUs after I trained. And, you know, I just remember thinking, wow. And, you know, nowadays you hear people doing 15, 20, 30, 40. You know, I know some of the guys do 32. They do a bottle of Serostim in the morning, then a bottle at night.
Wow.
You know, I know a handful of pros do that. So it's pretty crazy.
Do you think that there's a big difference between the farm grade stuff and the generics that we're able to more easily and for cheap prices?
Oh, I do. Absolutely. 100%. I'm not in the lab in China. I can't tell you that I've sat there and watched what their process is. But, you know, based on my experience and from the folks that I talk to, there is a big difference. You know, I mean, you know, there's always talk that these guys put anti-diuretic hormone in their GH to make you hold water. And then all these guys gain 9 or 10 pounds in a week or two. And they're like, oh, my God, I'm blowing up from this stuff. And, and you know, you kind of wonder, well, is it just water retention? And, like, I personally never had a lot of water retention from Humatrope or Serostim or things like that. But I remember when I tried the generics, it was the first time I'd ever had high blood pressure. You know, I was on the Muscle Mayhem forum, and there was a guy on there that was kind of well known for the GH, and I tried it because it was pretty cheap. And sure enough, man, my blood pressure shot up like crazy, and I was kind of like, "Yeah, I'm not so sure about this, man." You know?
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. You know, back to the seminar. You know, Scott, you're going to be presenting some stuff now from more of a scientific point of view, correct?
Yeah, I think we touched on this a little bit. Yeah, I mean, as far as, for instance, the bodybuilding pharmacology, I think, and this connects to something that John was talking that occurred to me, is that, you know, nowadays, overall, you would think that the more doses a person is using, the higher the doses or the more drugs, the longer period of time that would have taken them to work up to. Like they would have, you know, if there was some sort of logical progression, you know, what John and I both say, trying to get the most from the least. This would occur over the course of many years when they've tried to see if, you know, there's any difference between 1 to 1.5 grams and 1.5 and 2 grams. So you would expect that those guys have been in the game for a while, those competitors, and then along the way, they're also doing every other thing they can possibly do as far as recovery, training, their nutrition, and their other like non-pharmaceutical supplementation. And unfortunately, what you don't see, I mean, if you just sort of like think about the people that are, you know, who, and I'm not targeting anyone in particular here, but you don't tend to necessarily see that IFBB pros have the greatest amount of knowledge. Of course, we attribute that to them because you see those guys have the best physiques, obviously. But you don't, you see a lot of people that are talking about drugs, whether they're anonymous on a drug drug board or what have you, on a discussion board or Facebook or a closed group on Facebook, whatever it may be. You don't necessarily see a ton of knowledge about other topics come out. So that makes you think, like, what's going, how much is understanding has really gone into this drug use? How much do they really understand about what they're doing and why they're doing it? And things like laws of diminishing returns. And I think we had a question when we recorded the show previously, which should be out, I think, by the time we get this one out. Yep. And, you know, I tried to give some background information on that question related to using a TRT dose of testosterone and then just adding on top of that whatever other anabolic steroid the person might want to use. And what was missing from that was the basic understanding that, you know, these steroids are all competing to a certain degree, depending on their binding affinity, for the same receptors. Like a basic understanding of the pharmacodynamics of the drugs is missing. Yeah. A basic understanding of the endocrinology is missing. So it's kind of like how I would be if I just decided like I wanted to go and like create a street dragster, you know, and I just got this, I got a Ford Pinto, you know, and decided that's going to be a great frame, you know, to add turbo and nitro and who knows what else. And it's like, that would obviously be out of ignorance. I'd just be throwing things in there without really having enough knowledge to make use of those things. So somebody who's just sort of like following the information that they get on a discussion board or Facebook or what have you, without knowing really the other things that go into it and even what they're doing in, from a very basic physiological and pharmacological standpoint, they're not going to get the most out of whatever they're doing, and they're going to obviously have a chance of hurting themselves potentially via side effects. So that's kind of the idea. That's sorry for the somewhat, you know, negative rant, but that's the perspective that I'm coming at with my part of this, is to try to just give some baseline fundamental understanding of endocrinology when it comes to steroids and growth hormone. I'll probably touch on insulin a little bit too, so people kind of know like what's going on. Like as an example, something I'm going to add in there for sure is that, you know, normal endogenous growth hormone, which is of course very pulsatile in nature, it doesn't look really anything like what you get from an injection, a typical sub-Q or IM injection. Is like on the order of like 1.5 IUs a day. Like that's like a total day's worth of growth hormone in an adult. So if you're doing, you know, 10 IUs, well, you're like more than five times above what your body typically would see. So just having that knowledge gives you some perspective. If you have no idea what 10 IUs means, and everyone uses 10 IUs, you sort of think, well, 10 IUs is the basic place to start. Yeah. You got to use at least 10 IUs. If you don't know that, you know, normal testosterone production in a male is, you know, 7 to 10 milligrams a day, something along those lines. So, you know, 100 or 150 milligrams of a testosterone enanthate basically will replace that. Then you don't know that 1,000 milligrams of test is a boatload. It's a lot.
Yeah.
So, like, a lot of guys don't know that stuff because you don't see that. No one reiterates that. It's boring information. It doesn't tell you how much progress you're going to make. It's not exciting. But I think you got to have that so that you can then, you know, get what, if someone decides they're going to do these things, get as much out of it as you possibly can. So that's kind of my take on why I think the fundamental understanding of some of the science and physiology, pharmacology is important for people.
Nice. So this sounds this sounds great. This sounds like it'll be a nice marriage between, John, all of your real world experience that you've had in your life and with other people, along with Scott coming from this pharmacology side. I think it'll be a cool blend.
Yeah, I think so. I'm super excited. So we're looking forward to seeing everybody there.
Hey, how long have you guys been friends for, you, Scott and John?
Who says we're friends? What the hell are you talking about?
How long have you guys really? I mean, I'm sure you've known each other, you know, through you know, bodybuilding for a long time. But when did you guys become friends? I'm just kind of personally curious.
Shoot, man, I remember Scott on the boards, on the pro muscle boards, and I remember his little avatar. I remember thinking, man, look at that dude's back. He's a badass. But yeah, I remember I started talking to Scott in 2010, 2011, and we actually competed in the Masters Nationals in 2012.
Yeah.
And Scott and I were both in the first call out, and I just remember thinking, I had gotten to know Scott quite a bit to that point, and he, you know, obviously I think the world of him, and I remember just been super excited that he was in that first call out. And I remember that just kind of, you know, I just got little, you know, I'm getting old, but I have these little highlights in my head. I just remember that's one of the times that Scott and I, you know, got to kind of start to get to know each other anyway. So that kind of always stuck in my head.
I think, John, I think I wrote about that in one of the first things I did for your website, because that was a highlight in my mind when, you know, as people that might have seen this agenda, they'll let you know whether, at least they were doing this at the Masters National that year, whether you made the top five. Like, literally, you don't even know this until you kind of get back there that night. So it's kind of a last minute thing. And when they, you know, told me I'm in the top five to go out and receive a trophy, I was excited, you know, and it was cool. It was awesome. John went bonkers. John was, you know, I think he got second that year, John. And like, that pretty much counts for a lot of years, but so that's always a good guess for you, Joe. But so John was excited, obviously, but he was just went crazy when he found out that I was in the top five. And that was really cool. That was one of those things where I was just like, I got more excited about it. And I'm like, wow, this is what, you know, camaraderie and brotherhood and bodybuilding should be all about. You know, when you're stoked or more stoked for someone else than you are for yourself.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
I wanted to ask you then, John, kind of following that thought, how, knowing Scott, how has his training style influenced Mountain Dog? We talk a lot about fortitude training on Muscle Minds, and I think a lot of the listeners are either following the programs now, or they at least have a decently good idea of how Scott's programs work. I feel like in some ways there's some similarities, but there's a lot of differences too. How has he influenced you?
Well, here's the bottom line in my mind is, you know, you can be the smartest person in the world. You can understand origins and insertions and nerve innervations and all this stuff, but you have to have a certain level of intensity. And once you hit that level, you have to kind of learn how to manage it, not go overboard. And anybody who follows Scott knows that he does some really, really intense stuff, but he also has a real good grasp on pushing you, you know, to the limit, but not pushing you overboard. And that's pretty key. I mean, there's a lot of people who claim to be experts, and there's people out there who call themselves the hypertrophy expert, and there's all these people out there and I know all these cool things about kinesiology, and that stuff always was fascinating to me in college and in high school. But, you know, you have to be able to train really, really hard to get to to achieve the most you can out of your potential. You have to train really, really hard. But then you've got to have this understanding that only comes with experience on how to manage that. And, you know, that's one of the things that Scott's really good at. And that's the markings of a really good coach. It's somebody who can push you really hard, but know when to take one step back to take two forward. I mean, really, that's the biggest key if I had to put it down to one thing.
Interesting. And how about you, Scott? How has John's training styles influenced what you've done?
You know, the very first thing that popped in my head is, you know, and some of this, I think, well, I helped co-write John's book, The Brutality Mountain Dog Training. It was the same kind of partnership that we're doing for this seminar, because it's obviously John's training system, and then I, you know, took some of the ideas that I had, and then John had, and some that I had, and sort of backed it up scientifically. And of course, so then I got to know a lot about his training system that way. But the thing I knew knew just because his YouTube channel has been around for so long, and having talked to him before that and knowing that, is that, you know, he has used a variety in training, and, you know, things like the Meadows Row and some of the other exercises you can find on his YouTube channel as a way to promote muscle growth. And so one of the things that you know, I really put a premium on in fortitude training is variety in training. I get a lot of shit for this on my Instagram channel. Almost, probably like every third video or so, I'll have someone say, you know, why don't you just do a bent over row? Why do you get all fancy with these things? That I'm like, because they feel great, and variety is an important training principle. Mm. So having seen John that, and of course, you know, you take notice when someone's physique is phenomenal too. That was probably, you know, one of the pieces of information in the back of my head that really gave me even more confidence in the idea that I infused into fortitude training, that variety is super important, because, you know, you're going to have motor unit activation patterns that are the same or similar every time you do a given exercise, whereas obviously you can feel it differently. You can even see it in the pump you might get when you change up the exercise. And John and I are, neither of us are spring chickens. You know, finding the exercises that don't screw up your back or cause your knees to be painful or wreck your elbows, et cetera, is important. And that's another reason why I include variety in fortitude training, and tell people, regardless of what day of the training system it is, or if something doesn't feel right, you just don't do it. I know I've heard John say that, you know, it's just kind of a common sense thing. Don't, you know, you live to train another day, and it's a good training session, first and foremost, if you didn't get injured. John and I joke about that all the time. Like, how'd you train today? I didn't hurt myself. Okay, good. First thing on the checklist is checked off. So those sorts of things mainly kind of focus around variety and not being afraid to infuse that into your training plan for the day. But obviously training hard at the same time. So I think that's probably best to answer that question.
Nice.
Yeah.
You know, John, you come in contact with a lot of people. I know you've done a lot more seminars than just this one that's coming up. And, you know, I see you answering a lot of questions, both on the message board and on Facebook, as well as, you know, on these radio shows and at your seminars. People are, you know, trying to learn from you, and along the way, we're all making mistakes. Can you think of some of the common mistakes that people are making nowadays, be it in their nutrition or their training or their supplementation, things that maybe you could share here that might help people avoid some of those road bumps and, you know, continue making progress without having to, you know, get caught up?
Well, a lot of us, I mean, the first thing that comes to my head are some very basic things like nutrition, for example. Many times people say, man, I can't put on any weight no matter how much I eat. And I'll go, well, how many calories do you eat a day? And they'll say, I don't know. Hmm. You know, and if someone doesn't know what they're consuming, then how do they know? You know, if you're not following a plan, then it's kind of hard to make an adjustment to the plan. So, you know, there's some very common sense things that, again, that come to mind first. So someone says, well, I can't lose weight, or I can't gain weight. Well, the first thing you need to do is you need to understand what you're doing. If you don't understand what you're doing, then how can you make a change? How can I tell you to add, well, I need you to add 300 calories, or, you know, I don't know. You know, maybe you eat heavy one day and you don't eat anything the next day. So nutritionally, I just don't think people even pay attention to what they're doing a lot of times. Training-wise, I just don't think people train hard enough. Hmm. You know, there's this fear of overtraining that exists out there. One of the cool things at my seminars, and man, this is something I really love. So at every seminar I do, I try to have a practical part of it as well. In other words, actually training. And one of the things that I see with these people is I'm pushing really hard. They'll go, man, I didn't know I could do that. And this is very common. This happened in England. It happened in Ireland. It's happened in Australia both times. It's happening everywhere I go, and I have these seminars. People will say, man, in Denmark, I just didn't know I could do that. I had no idea. Hmm. And I just think people don't know. I mean, they don't push their body. They don't even understand what they're even capable of. And look, I'm a big proponent of perfect form and all this stuff. But none of that stuff matters if you can't really, really push yourself hard. So, you know, nutritionally, I just don't think people really have a plan. They're just kind of winging it. The first thing I would tell someone is you need to know what you're doing. How many grams of protein are you eating? How many carbohydrates are you eating? How many grams of fat are you eating? Training wise, how many sets are you doing to failure? You know, are you taking any beyond to any beyond failure? Those are really basic answers, but I think if people did those things well, it'd probably solve 90% of their problems.
I could see that. Hey, Scott, do you have anything that you'd like to add to this? Things that you've seen people doing that they may be able to avoid?
Avoid.
Speed bumps, basically. Avoiding the speed bumps or the pitfalls.
You know, I was listening to John. I'm gonna answer his, say that I see, first of all, I see the same things. And another way to sort of address that is to recognize that to a certain degree, as I've said before, that bodybuilding is an unnatural act. Hmm. Really, both dietarily, if you're trying to make gains, or dieting down, as well as training. We've got our body's physiology is set up dietarily, nutritionally, to limit our hunger, to hold us back. You know, it doesn't feel good when you're trying to eat and put food down when you're not hungry, because you're trying to promote size gains. People vary as to how well they can do that. But so the road bump or the mistake that they make is to think that they can do just what John said, that I can just, you know, eat as much as I feel like I can and don't pay attention to what they're actually eating. It's like, well, I eat till I'm full. I eat as much as I can. Well, if you're not really paying attention and tracking those things, then you're going to fall prey to your body's normal homeostatic mechanisms. You're going to just not eat as much. You're going to stop eating so much. You're going to, oh, I missed a meal. I'll try to eat more next time. And your normal appetite control mechanisms and metabolic set point and settling point mechanisms are going to come into play. And, you know, you'll be shot in the foot. Training is the same way. I've seen that every all my training camps. I've seen that, and even when I train with people one on one, same thing. John said, like they're like, oh my god, I had no idea. Or you know, I think I might have mentioned this like this recently on the show. The stretching and fortitude training is something people kind of blow off, and every time I do a training camp, people are like, holy crap, that stretch is harder than the set if you do it the way you did. I'm like, yeah, it's in the book there, but you're just not doing it. And those are both examples of the body trying to protect itself and the mind kind of trying to protect itself. You literally have to be a little out of your mind, so to speak. Yeah. You have to be willing to do something that is painful, that is kind of noxious. It's very, very difficult. Because you're trying to make your body adapt to something, and in order that it hasn't already adapted to. In order to do that, you're going to have to do something you haven't ever done. So in training, that means one, kind of what John was saying, is push yourself in a way you never have before that you didn't know you're able to. And you know, I always talk about, you know, I said this to someone recently. I may have been in the gym. I can't remember. I have these conversations so regularly. I said, you know, imagine now if, you know, I took your entire family and we put them on a platform and they're dangling above a pit of molten lava above a volcano. How many reps would you get? Would you get 10 reps? You're like, yeah, I would. I said, I have no doubt that you would, because I know how much you care about your family. You would do it. It would happen.
Yeah.
You know, or you would die trying. Now, you don't want to die during your set. It shouldn't literally be a Widowmaker or a death set. But when you frame things in that perspective of what you're capable of under those dire circumstances, people will do things they're not used to doing. So you got to like do things like keep a dietary record as far as nutrition goes, and then using a training log to at least try to ensure like you have something to tell you, you know, hey, well, guess what? You know, I'm lifting the same weights for the same reps last year as I am now. No wonder nothing's changed in the gym. Why would it? And then, of course, that leads to the next logical step, which is to ensure some progressive overload. Now, some people who train really hard and want to train hard and are also maybe somewhat ego-driven with loads will say, you know, you know, that big bastard across the gym I see every day, he's you know, incline pressing 315 for sets of 10. I got to get him. I know he's huge. And if I can get, you know, at least as strong as he is, I'll look a lot bigger. So they sort of intuitively undergo the pain and suffering that comes with pushing themselves that hard in the gym. But most people won't necessarily do that. You have to make a logbook into your adversary. It's basically sort of your nemesis in a way, is one way to look at it. And so both of those things are like, they're sort of unnatural acts of self-torture that come with bodybuilding. So it's a bizarre thing to do. But I think the people that go to seminars that John and I do, you know, they're looking for those ways. They just don't necessarily know what they don't know, which is that, you know, if you just listen to your body too much and don't constrain it to some form of progression at the dining table and in the gym, you're not going to make progress. So
it's
same sorts of things, really.
It's a fascinating topic to me, intensity. And it is something I was just talking about with you on message, Scott, you know, trying to figure out how to convey to somebody just, you know, what that is. I can say that I felt like at a time that I was training really intense. And at that time I was training harder than I had been in the past. But then, you know, like I met Shelby Starnes and started working out with him. And then I realized, like, a light bulb went off and I saw, oh wait, I can actually take this further. But before that, I thought I was doing 100%. Like, I really thought in my mind that this was 100%.
It's all relative.
Yeah.
I think I may have told this story before. I'll make it kind of quick. Did a lot of pain testing when I was in grad school. We're doing a bunch of testing on, we had like 70 college age subjects, and we did some muscle soreness and we did some pressure algometry press on the quad muscle, which was sore. And this one guy had suffered tremendous strength loss. So I know we whacked his quad with the muscle damage protocol. But I noticed, like, on this basically a 0 to 100 scale, he was putting like, he was getting like 2 and 3. Hmm. And I'm like, what in the world? I know he got weaker. And I asked him afterwards, I said, hey, you know what, have you had extraordinary painful experiences in your life? And and he said, I've told this before. He's like, yeah, I had open heart surgery when I was a kid. I think I'm like 2 times where they cut open his chest cavity. And he also impaled himself when he was trying to jump over a wrought iron fence on his dirt bike. And he like was like lying there impaled for like an hour. So for him, he's experienced some major pain, you know. His perspective on, oh, you're pressing on my leg with this little measuring device, well, that's nothing.
Nothing,
you know?
Compared to getting impaled, right?
I've literally been impaled. So it's all relative. And the same thing goes for effort and pain in the gym, you know. So you're right. Finding someone like Shelby or you know, someone who, like John, you know, who can really push.
Or you.
Shifts your perspective. Well, yeah, maybe for some people, me, could be.
So, you know, John, you have a passion, I know, specifically for training. You focus on all the aspects of what it takes to be good at bodybuilding, but I know that your heart is really in training. I wanted to ask you, you know, when you're coming up against somebody, you have a client, somebody who has a lagging body part, what are some of the reasons why this body part might not be developing as well as some of the others?
Well, the first thing you got to consider is genetics, you know. But, you know, when it comes to actually helping someone, the first thing you got to evaluate is how they're training. You know, if someone has a poor chest, and if you watch them press and their sternum caves in and you can literally see all the stress going to their front delts, then there's a problem with how they're actually training. Mm. A lot of people want to jump on frequency, but the first thing you got to do is make sure they're doing things in the most efficient way possible. You know, their form has to be good. So you got to look at how someone's actually training before you can determine whether you're going to add sessions. And I just mentioned that because the first answer most people give is, well, you just add sessions, just make them train more. But if there's something broken with their technique, then training more doesn't help. So you have to evaluate what they're doing, number one. And then, you know, you may find some things that are broken and you can fix it. And maybe that fixes the issue. If you find that they're training awesome, you can see that they're isolating the muscle well, they're stressing it hard, you know, they're doing all the things you think they need to do. And then, yeah, maybe you do add some frequency. One of the things I see with increasing frequency that's a problem is people don't back off of the other stuff. So let's say someone's training really hard their whole body and they say, okay, I'm going to increase the frequency on my leg training. But they keep killing their chest. They keep killing their back. You know, your body doesn't have an unlimited amount of recovery. And, you know, I saw something that Brad Schoenfeld just put out there saying that training 3 times a week isn't necessarily training better than training 2 times a week. And the first thing I thought in my head is, well, in your study, did you change the variable of recovery? Did you allow them to recover and back off their other body parts? Because in my experience, when you back off of other body parts, then focusing on increasing frequency can really help. You know, I build my 3 most recent training programs. I have blocks of 4 to 6 weeks of increased frequency. And it's working really, really well for people. But I do have them back off on their strong points. So to answer your question, you got to understand, you know, how they executing their exercises. That's number one. And then maybe it's frequency. Hmm. You know, and then there's also the physiological things. Maybe there's something wrong with, I don't know, you know, maybe there's some nerve compression and, you know, maybe there's something wrong with their nervous system. You know, you can also have issues like that that I can't figure out. They just need to see a specialist to figure out those things.
That makes sense. So how often are you training right now, John?
I train 5 days a week. I train my back twice a week and I train everything else once a week. Right now, that's what I'm doing. It can change at any time, but that's what I'm doing right now.
What's your reasoning for doing back twice?
It recovers the fastest and it's my weakest body part. Hmm. So it just makes sense for me to go ahead and nail it twice.
So if you don't mind me asking, how do you split that up? And then what are you seeing when you say it recovers the fastest? You're saying like the soreness goes away in that period of time?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. And so you split that up just kind of evenly throughout the week, like say Monday and Thursday or something?
Yeah, I do Wednesday and Saturday. So I'm given, you know, the Wednesday workout. You know, my back is interesting. I can punish it and it'll recover in time. But if it was my chest, you know, I would split it up differently. I would, the first day I trained it, I would probably punish it with a lot of compound exercises. But the second time I trained it, I would not. Because I just think doing, like, for example, barbell bench press is hard twice a week. I just think you're asking for trouble, you know, with your soft tissues. But back is interesting. You can. I feel like I can punish it really hard on Wednesday and I'm fine to do it again on Saturday. But like with back, with chest and legs, I would do it a little bit differently. I would punish it, then give it 3 days off and not two. And then I would use exercises that doesn't, you know, beat you up quite as bad.
Interesting. How long are your workouts?
You know, today we went crazy on back and it took exactly 55 minutes.
Really? Wow. That's quick.
It's kind of surprised me. So we did probably 7 or 8 sets of cable rows. And then we did supported T-bar rows, you know, a chest supported row.
Oh, yeah.
And then we did pullovers. Mm. Our arms, you know, just give your arms a little bit of a break. And then we did, there's a pretty cool pull down machine that's a little unique that we did. We did that. And I think that might have been it. But we went pretty heavy today. You know, we were using the whole stack on the cable rows and on the T-bar rows. We had 4 plates, and I mean, for an old guy like me, that's pretty heavy.
Heavy. So, John, I got a question for you. It's just interesting because I'm thinking about, you know, what you're doing now, and you've got so many Mountain Dog training programs out there, and you know, I imagine over time they're getting better and better to a certain degree. But are there like a top 3 or 4 programs as far as what you've seen, as far as results and people just raving about and like going back to because it just works so good, works so well for just putting on size, like your top 3 best sellers or most popular?
Well, the most popular one is Creeping Death. I don't know if you remember that. Okay. That literally is from like, God, maybe that was like 4 years ago. And that is a 5-day program, and the 5th day is extra chest and shoulders. Now, that one was my first experience with starting to increase frequency. Mm-hmm. And my chest, I felt like I could have used the most work, and that's why I picked that body part. that one still to this day, man, is the one that people seem to love the most. If I had to pick a second and a third one, I can tell you my favorite one. My favorite one was Program 18, which I did a couple years ago. That's the one that has very little direct arm work, and it has a ton of chest and back and leg work. I had kind of beat up elbows, and it was to the point where I was, you know, you have injuries and you think to yourself, okay, I'm never going to be the same. It was, was pretty bad. It was
every week.
Yeah. Well, you know, those things, like, you just, I've had probably 15 of those where I just think, man, I'll never be the same. But I had lateral and medial epicondylitis on both arms. It was when I would curl my arms up, they would pop and crack like you wouldn't believe. So I was just like, you know what? I'm just going to do a ton of torso and leg work. And I did that program. It was 12 weeks and my elbows healed and my arms didn't look any different. And I would surmise that it was just because I was doing my chest and back so much.
Right.
But that one was awesome because, like, all my elbow pain went away and my arms actually didn't change at all. So that's kind of one of my favorites. And then there's, for legs, there's one called Carnage. And actually, you and I did one of the workouts in it. You just don't know it. It was the one we did at Dave's where we did the Bulgarian split squats.
Oh, yeah. With
that was actually
Shrek.
With the Shrek on the cage. That was that was one of the leg workouts in Program 17. It's called Carnage. That one's pretty popular, too. That one's pretty brutal. You know, the ones I do now are more higher frequency with blocks of time, you know. 4 weeks of chest and 4 weeks of back, 4 weeks of legs. But some of those older ones, man, those still to this day are the most popular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got clients now and again that are a lot of times are doing those. I always ask in my history, you know, what your favorite training program is or was, or what you seem to have the best progress with. A lot of times it's mountain dog training. And I've even got one person I started with not long ago who would, while I was waiting to get him in, he bought one of your programs and he started doing it and, you know, it was working great. So we just saw, you know, that's what we're doing. We're going to just ride that out because he just wanted to do it and he had so much success. So that's cool.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Where can people find that stuff in case they don't know?
Oh, it's easy. MountainDogDiet.com. Then there's a programs tab. It doesn't have all my programs, but it probably has about, I don't know, 10 or 12 of them on there.
Enough to keep you pretty busy, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, too, what are your plans competitively for 2018?
I don't really have any plans right now, Scott. I am working hard on my business. I just moved to a new house. I think I mentioned that earlier, and we're trying to get settled in here. My kids are about to be homeschooled.
Oh, really?
So that's going to be an interesting thing. You know, they're in third grade, so we're going to try homeschooling them for a year or two max.
What made you guys decide to go that route out of curiosity?
Well, you know, my kids go to a pretty nice private school, and you would think that, you know, it'd be the other kids that they are around would, you know, behave somewhat normally, but they're coming home, they're getting exposed to things that they, quite frankly, I don't think they should be exposed to until they're a little bit older. And so, you know, my wife decided to homeschool them for the next year or two. You know, I understand that you can't shelter them forever.
Yeah.
But when you're in third grade, you don't want them hearing the kind of language and hearing the kind of things that they're hearing.
Fair enough.
You know, just... You know, it's frustrating. You know, you spend a lot of money to send them to a private school, and then they come home, they're like, oh, yeah, guess what David said today? And you're like, oh, my God.
Yeah. This is what we're paying for?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So
we got a lot going on, man. I just really haven't had time to think a whole lot about competing. It's I'm training very, very hard right now. You know, I was training with Ben Hartman yesterday, and Ben was kind of like, you know, you didn't let down on your intensity, you know, with no – competitive plans, and I suspect Scott and I are kind of the same in that manner. No matter how, if we're competing or not, we still just enjoy training hard, you know.
Yep. Yeah.
Got one more question for you. I look at people that I know and I look at their dogs and I see similarities between these people and their dogs. You know, you can find coffee table books and you can see like a guy that has a bulldog and he kind of looks like a bulldog. What traits of the mountain dog do you see in yourself?
They're lazy. You know, when, okay, so when I was trying to figure out what kind of dog
John, I want to have to call you on that one, because you're not lazy, my man. Not one bit. Sorry, you can't get away with that. That's not true. Try again.
Well, when I was trying to figure out what kind of dog I wanted, I was watching the Westminster Dog Show, right? The biggest one. This is the Super Bowl, right? And I mean, obviously Scott and I are both huge dog advocates and we love dogs. So I see a Bernese Mountain Dog and I'm like, you know, it's very striking in its appearance. I'm like, man, that's a beautiful dog. So I start doing a little reading. You know, I think people run out and they buy dogs and they don't have any idea what they're getting into, what the dog needs and all those things. And I was smart enough to know you at least should do some investigating and educating yourself before you buy a dog. So I start reading about the Mountain Dog, the Bernese Mountain Dogs, and I'm like, you know, it says, you know, they're good natured, you know, get along well with people and other dogs. They don't need a lot of exercise. They just like hanging out with you. And they're, you know, they're dry mouths. They're not going to drool everywhere. And so I thought, cool. So I went, I was looking for breeders. I found one in Toledo, Ohio. I went and got a Bernese Mountain Dog. And, you know, for me, it's a great breed. I just lost Atlas, my other one. He just died. He was almost 12 years old, died about 2 months ago.
Sorry, man.
But, you know, for me, it's a great breed. They're real gentle. They just like hanging out with you. You know, just a really good breed, man. Very intelligent, but they just like sitting around and hanging out with you. And I kind of like that, you know.
Nice. I was waiting for something about how they have this this intuitive nature that carries them through the forest and they don't stop or, you know, something like that.
Well, they originally were in, you know, if you look up their history, they pulled milk carts in Switzerland, the Canton of Bern. That's where you get the name Bernese Mountain Dog, from the Canton of Bern. And they pulled milk carts. So you got to be careful, like when you're training them to walk, that you don't like pull back on them, because they just want to pull harder. Like that's not how you teach them to walk beside you, because they love to pull. I used to go to these competitions where they would have dogs try to pull, you know, the one that pulled the most weight would win. And it was so much fun. And that's one of their instincts, is to pull really hard. And they, you know, they love cold weather. They love snow. I am kind of a cold weather guy. I do kind of like cold weather. So I guess you could compare me there.
Mm-hmm. You took Atlas to pulling competition. Like, he competed in those.
Oh, really?
Is that what you're saying, John?
Well, no, I was going to the pulling competitions when I had Lucy. She was my first one. I took her to dog shows, and she I took her to a huge dog show here in the region, and she got second place.
Nice.
And then I took her to another dog show, and she won, and she was doing really well competitively, and she actually died of cancer. She was only 4 years old. So I went to get Atlas, and I wanted to get a show dog, because I really enjoy showing dogs, at least I used to. And so, you know, they're sending you pictures and you get real attached to them. And then I get there to pick him up and she's like, well, you know, he's got an overbite and he doesn't have the white tip on his tail that's required in competition. And, you know, so he's not show quality. You know, do you want a different dog? And I'm like, well, that at that point, you're already attached to him.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like, hell no, you know. So I never showed him. And what
she knew that too. When you like that was going to happen. Like, if you're this is what it is, John. He was an underdog, like you have been for so much of at least your bodybuilding career. That's a connection. Yeah.
So I didn't think I was going to show him, and I got him fixed, and then son of a bitch. And then his like overbite went away. And then he did get like a few little white hairs on the tip of his tail. And I was like, son of a gun, man.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't show him when you fix him, right? So I couldn't do that. But so he did overcome it. You know, he didn't have the best genetics, but he overcame it. And I certainly had kind of shitty genetics, and maybe I've done okay too.
I like that. Wow. I like that analogy. That's so back to the seminar, guys. Let's hear the information. This is Bodybuilding Fact and Fiction. Tell me if I'm right. DoubleTree Hotel. This will be. What's the date exactly, if you remember offhand?
It's the 1st of March, which is that Thursday. And just in case people are wondering, it's the DoubleTree Suites in downtown Columbus. It's like 0.8 miles away from the convention center. So it's, you know, like probably a $3 Uber if it's really cold, or, you know, a quick walk. if you're if you're staying someplace close to where the Arnold will be. So it's right there in the thick of things.
Nice. And John, where can everybody reach out to you if they want to get a hold of you? Check out your programs and check out the products that you offer, your services, everything.
Yeah, mountaindogdiet.com.
Easy enough. And for the seminar, is that at fortitudetraining.net, Scott?
Yes. There is up at the top along my the header of my page, there's a, this is Meadows Stevenson Pre-Arnold Seminar, something like that. You can get a ticket there and go through the payment with PayPal, credit cards, PayPal, whole kit and caboodle. Easy stuff to do.
Awesome. And this is going to be like an all-day thing, basically. Like from what I saw on the flyer, it's like 9 to noon and then into the afternoon as well.
Yep.
All right. Yep.
All day.
Very cool. Is there limited seating for this?
I think our limit is technically 100. So, you know, hey, the more the better. I do this, I think John does this too, and to try to just, this is a really kind of about helping people overall, you know. I mean, this isn't like a $900 seminar or anything like that. So, you know, if we could get, you know, 100 people there, that would be awesome. That would be fantastic. The nice thing about this is that it's, because this one is just an informational seminar, there won't be a situation where we got way too many people jammed in a gym and we can't give them the kind of one-on-one attention you'd want to. So you're not no one's missing out on anything the more people we have. So I think the room holds up to 100. So hopefully we'll fill it up.
Yeah. I like that. And I think you're really hitting on a good point, Scott. I can really see that you guys are doing this because you care and because you want to give something back to the community. And I have a lot of respect for that. So I really appreciate, guys, that you're doing this for us.
Well, there's not many people in the sport that does it, right? I mean, people do meet and greets, but nobody's really out there educating. So we're just trying to do our part and help.
Awesome. Well, we will look forward to seeing you guys at the Arnold Classic and seeing you at this event. Anything I'm missing here, Scott?
I don't think so. You have been, you've checked off the list from top to bottom as usual.
All right. I try. John, I really appreciate you coming on, man, and being with us. This is, you know, I look up to you a ton. It's great to have seen you do everything you've done competitively, and now to see everything that you're doing in business. It's really inspirational to me, honestly.
Oh, thank you, man. I appreciate that.
Guys, for Muscle Minds, with Dr. Scott Stevenson, I'm Scott McNally, and special guest, John Meadows.
Adios.
If you've enjoyed Scott Stevenson's contribution to Muscle Minds, you can learn more about him, his products, and his services at fortitudetraining.net. And if you order any of his products or services, you get a free subscription to his message board where he answers questions daily. Go to fortitudetraining.net to learn more about all these products, services, and events offered by Scott Stevenson.
Voices Radio.